Hello and welcome to Systems of Harm, a podcast brought to you by Frankly Design. I'm your host, Amy Hupe, and each week I'll be speaking to a new guest about their experience of working with design systems and their personal experiences of marginalisation. Today's guest is Laura Parker. Laura is a content designer and an inclusive language consultant working on public sector services in the UK. She has dyslexia and dyscalculia, which is a learning difference characterised by a persistent difficulty in understanding numbers. In this episode, Laura and I talk about the ways that dyscalculia affects her day-to-day life and how we can design more inclusive products and services that support her and others like her. Well, welcome to Systems of Harm, Laura. Thank you so much for coming on.
Hi.
Hello.
Thank you for inviting me. Hiya.
No, thank you for coming. It's I'm really, really excited to talk to you about this because obviously you and I have spoken a little bit kind of offline about this. And I was fascinated when you started talking about dyscalculia because, interestingly, as soon as you started describing the symptoms and the kind of signs to look for, I don't know if I have it, but I immediately identified with a lot of them. So I guess where I'd really like to start this conversation is with a bit of a kind of explanation for people who haven't heard of dyscalculia. And we're going to talk about dyslexia too. But what is dyscalculia?
Yeah, it's a great question. First of all, the word is really horrible to say, pronounce, spell. So it's dyscalculia. Don't worry if you get it wrong. I get it wrong all the time. And it's defined as a specific and persistent difficulty in understanding numbers. And there are a few characteristics that people with dyscalculia have. Some people might have more than others. So I think that's the kind of across most of the spectrums. It's not like a playbook of, you know, you've got all these things. So it's rather diverse. But some of the characteristics you might find if you do have dyscalculia is like a poor sense of numbers, an underestimation and telling the time. I'll get into my personal story later, but time is a real stickler for me. I do struggle with time a lot. Things like low mental arithmetic skills, high levels of math anxiety as well, difficulties with working memory. This is not specific to numbers, just generally having such short-term memory recall. Remembering directions, that kind of thing, that's actually really hard for me to do. I think the thing is with dyscalculia is a lot of adults particularly will know they struggle with numbers, but they won't necessarily have heard of dyscalculia. So when they're searching for advice, they're probably not searching the term dyscalculia. They might search for things like maths anxiety or low numeracy. So there is a difference between the three of those. So we've got dyscalculia, which is a neurodiverse condition, similar to dyslexia. But we've also got low numeracy and math anxiety, and absolutely everyone can experience those things in life. I don't know if you're a maths whiz or not, but if you have math anxiety, you might feel if you're doing sort of maths puzzles or calculations, you might start to sweat or feel hot, all the kind of common symptoms of anxiety. Low numeracy is similar. So we categorize low numeracy as people who've left school earlier, perhaps haven't had the opportunity to really educate themselves around numbers. So that's like early school leavers, prison leavers, people who have left education early for whatever reason. But yeah, those are the three kind of distinct paths, but they kind of mingle together like most stuff, really. And I would say that I probably have all three.
Wow. Do they sort of intersect, do they? Is that what you mean? So they kind of, it's quite common to have overlaps between those things.
Definitely. I think if you've left school, so my family, I'm the first person in my family to go to university. My mum left school, I think, at around 14. No one graduated past high school. So they're what we would class as kind of early school leavers. And their literacy and numeracy skills are very, very low. And so growing up from that background, there was no focus on like extracurricular activities or any sort of home. I couldn't get help with homework, that kind of thing. And I remember because we're kind of going into just my personal history now, but dyscalculia, the research around dyscalculia is about 30 years behind dyslexia. So some schools are not, they don't look out for the signs. I think things like autism, dyslexia, school teachers perhaps look out for the signs of those things more than they do dyscalculia, and hopefully it will change. So I had zero support from school and from my family at home. So it kind of meant I was in this position where I was really struggling to understand numbers and the time and things like that, but I couldn't get help from anywhere. And so I just had low numeracy until I was able to, as an adult, teach myself. Unfortunately, that was the way of the land for me. And then obviously having low numeracy skills means that I get math anxiety. But dyscalculia, it was something that I was probably had all along.
Yeah.
And it's just gone into the mix, you know, it's a mixed bag of things. But somebody might have math anxiety and be a scholar, or they could be, you know, they could be at Cambridge or Oxford. You know, math anxiety could affect anyone, no matter of math ability.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the reason that we're sort of having this conversation is because this whole series is exploring ways that design systems can kind of perpetuate or indeed kind of mitigate some of the kind of common barriers that people face when they're trying to use digital services, so websites and applications. So could you perhaps give us some examples of some patterns and some common things that you encounter that might be difficult if you have dyscalculia?
Yeah, I have a list of things to mention about this, because there might be some unexpected ways that people assume people just get by without any struggle. So I tell you what, before I go into specific like design elements, I'll just talk about some of the things that I find particularly hard or difficult in life. So things like being late. So I couldn't really tell the time properly until I was perhaps in my late 20s. I have different tools that help me to tell the time now, but it's one of those things that I've struggled with for forever. Mm-hmm. So that means I'm often late to appointments, which means that if I have an appointment, specifically a medical appointment, and it's sort of later in the day, I feel like I can't do anything until that appointment's done, because I'm so paranoid about being late to it. So I often get there half an hour early, and then that whole day there is lost to this one appointment. There's things like missing trains and buses, and even struggling to understand flights. So usually if you go to a train station or a bus station, there's this way of showing the destination and then the time of departure.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's in like a table format where you have the destination on the left and the time of departure on the right. So I really struggle with left and right. Again, this is another a characteristic of someone with dyscalculia, dyslexia or dyspraxia. And sometimes it's really difficult to see which time the train's actually departing. So that means I get on the wrong train. So whenever I get a train, I don't get buses anymore, but when I get a train, I'll often ask somebody or clarify with them that I'm on the correct train.
Right.
Just to make sure that I'm actually on the right one.
Yeah.
Distances and kind of navigation is really difficult. If I go into a building, like my office, for example, is very, very big and has lots of corridors and things, I probably couldn't work out how to get out of there. If you gave me a map, I wouldn't get out of there. So sometimes that's really anxiety provoking if I'm going to a gig or something in a big conference place, or a big, you know, there's loads of people anyway, which is always kind of anxiety provoking, but I just don't know how to get out, and sometimes that worries me. And so I make a real effort to check where the exits are, and okay, I came in this door and it's left here, because even though the chances of something happening are quite slim, I just feel that I'm not confident if it did happen that I would get to safety. Let's see, accessing online services and using like two-factor authentication is another way that I struggle, and I get locked out of accounts very often, which is really annoying, because sometimes you have to ring up a place and they kind of assume you're a fraud because you've been locked out of your account several times.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to explain, okay, well, it's hard for me. It's especially hard on things like if you're using an authentication app and it gives you 10 seconds to remember the code. That's difficult for me. I actually have to transfer, if I'm using an app, for example, transfer the numbers onto a piece of paper, because I always get the numbers in the wrong order. They kind of appear fuzzy and distorted. And so writing them down helps me to accentuate the shape of them. And then I have to input that onto whatever device I'm using. So that whole process takes longer than 10 seconds sometimes. And so like getting locked out of accounts is really, it's horrible. You have to ring up, they presume you're fraudster, you have to go through the security checks. So that's just one other reason or way, I guess, that I get caught out.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah.
That sounds pretty difficult. No, I was just going to say, it brings out a theme that I think I've heard in a few of the conversations we've had on this podcast, which is that we certainly have kind of power to make some of these things easier. And you mentioned some digital patterns there, like the timer and having to kind of transpose information from one place to another. But it also strikes me that there are some things that need to be dealt with on the kind of service side, so away from the digital kind of interface that you're dealing with. So, for example, when you say you phone up and they kind of treat you like you're trying to commit fraud, that must feel very, very kind of othering, I suppose, and quite uncomfortable to have to be confronted with over and over again.
Yes, it is. And one of the things I like to say is that numbers are emotional, and so sometimes there can be trauma and emotion wrapped up in numbers. And I think we talk about numbers as cold, hard facts, but I feel like they have meaning. And it's really interesting because if you think about things like COVID-19, climate change, inflation, that's all numbers. To understand, you know, I remember when COVID was kind of peaking, and there used to be a show at 5 p.m. on the news, and it would show graphs of the kind of uptake in people getting COVID. I really didn't understand the gravity of that. I felt like I had to ask like my partner and my friends, like, what's going on? So I didn't quite have access to information. And it's the same with understanding things like climate change, understanding that like numbers are emotional, and sometimes we forget that. And I think it causes harm because some people can't understand the gravity of these situations, and yet they're not catered to. So it's like understanding, there's like two things. There's the numbers themselves and improving how they look on a screen. So for example, leaving space around numbers because they appear distorted sometimes, and it helps me to pick out the shapes of them. There's also explaining what the numbers mean in real terms, in terms that are plain and easy to understand. And that's when things like, it's like going into an Aldi and thinking, why is this tin of tomatoes now £1.50 and it used to be 60p? Why is that? And that's inflation, and understanding what inflation means. And there's so many people, if we look at early school leavers, people with mass anxiety, where they're not thinking about this. They're already masking anyway. They're probably already in a situation where numbers is already stressful. So to understand what inflation means, or climate change, or COVID, and how impactful that is on their lives, I think it's that extra element. And that's something we have to do. We have to make sure that everyone understands what's actually happening in this way. Yeah. Where was I? Yeah, so we also have to think about who we're excluding. So presenting numbers clearly is not just about how they look on a screen. And I think I've just repeated myself there. But let's have a look at who's actually dealing with services which are number heavy. So I was doing a lot of research into how many young carers deal with family finances. So we've got lots of young people at that. I was one of them. Like I said, my parents left school early. They didn't quite understand financial concepts. So I was not only struggling with money, but I had to go to the post office, deal with letters from the bank, letters from utility companies. So we've got a chunk of young people who are dealing with finances for the family. And so if we can make our services simple, it's going to help those people. We've got people with ADHD who on average spend about £1,600 more than everybody else because they struggle to manage their money. So we've got the banking sector who could do lots of cool things to help people with that. Let's see. Yeah, I've talked about prison leavers and kind of early school leavers who are looking for financial support, maybe benefits or something like that. And of course, disabled and neurodiverse people as well. So if we're not designing better number-related services or presenting numbers clearly, those people we could be excluding.
Yeah.
Services.
Yeah, as you say, it's a really kind of broad, broad set of people that are affected by this. I remember watching a really interesting talk a few years ago about somebody whose father had bipolar, during one of his kind of, sorry, I'm probably using the wrong terminology here, but during one of his kind of manic periods, he would really struggle with money and would, you know, want to spend a lot of money in this quite erratic way and this quite kind of harmful way for them. And so the talk was all about kind of creating almost like healthy friction to accessing your money. But that's actually quite interesting for me because some of what you said here almost seems to contradict that, I think, because for some people you want to create this healthy friction, for other people you want to do the opposite. It's like they know they want to access their money and we want to make it as friction free as we can for them. And when you're putting in barriers like the timer and things, so maybe it's about kind of creating the right sort of barriers and creating that clarity, as you say, around not just the numbers themselves, but what do they actually mean.
Yeah, so something that's been really helpful as a design pattern is the check your answers review type of pattern where, so I remember I had a kind of bank account. I think I got my first bank account at 15 or 16, and it was the one my parents used, and it was one of the high street brands, and it was, you know, old school. And when I started my first job, I remember I'd always struggled to pay the right amount of money. So I would be sending £200 instead of 20 because that extra zero in my mind, it looks the same as 20. There's no distinction between 20 and 200 and 2000. Sometimes I don't understand. Usually you get money. Sometimes it's displayed as 20.00 as a £20. Sometimes we read that as 2000. So I used to make loads of mistakes. I lost so much money. Anyway, obviously now recently I use an online bank, and before I do any exchange, it pops up and it plays back to me the amount I'm going to pay. And I've caught that so many times and I've been like, actually no, I'm sending the wrong amount, like, oh my god. And I've gone back and been able to review. In terms of timers, yeah, I hate timers.
Yeah.
They make me feel so much under pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it can take me like 4 or 5 attempts to get the number correct. Especially another kind of design pattern that needs to be refocused is the sort of a reference number or use of a reference number. So many, especially in government, you get lots of reference numbers for various different things. And because I'm quite obsessed with getting the numbers correct, I have like a log of them that I write down and keep on paper. And then having to input that reference number back in, especially if it's numbers and letters together, that's real, it's really hard for me to do that.
And when it's case sensitive too as well, I find that difficult. And, you know, and I don't think I have dyslexia. And yeah, I find anything where there's like different cases and stuff quite challenging.
Exactly. So how challenging does this reference number need to be to fit the purpose of what you're trying to do? So I had a conversation with someone and they told me that they used reference numbers to confirm an action. But the reference number didn't mean anything. It didn't mean anything. If it was my case, I'd be thinking, I'd obviously keep a record of it. And I'd be like, when do I need to use this number again? Like, are you going to ask me for this number again? Do I need to keep it safe? What happens if I lose this number? So if you are using reference numbers, please just tell the people, like, you will need this when you X, or don't keep this number, you don't need it. You'll need this number next time when you sign in. Just give more context around the reference number, why it's important, that kind of thing, because that can just cause quite a lot of anxiety.
I think, you know, a lot of what you've talked about is how disempowering this can be. So I guess, like, giving more information is a way of giving back some of that power, because you're telling people what you're doing with the information that you're getting from them and that you're giving. So it's helping to understand mm-hmm. better.
Exactly. And I think context is key here. Anything that you're requiring someone to do, so in this case, a reference number, you're requiring someone to remember it. So as I said in the beginning, my short-term memory and recall is really bad. So I do write down these things. And it's one of the things that that we talk about a lot about dyscalculia is filling in the information you already know and not expecting people to repeat or remember numbers. If you're filling in a form, for example, it'd be really handy to copy and paste a number. There are some apps that do it. I think PayPal are really good, where you sign in and it kind of auto-fills the number for you. But some forms don't let you do that. And if you're going through a multiple complex journey over multiple screens, for example, and you're having to remember numbers or addresses or things like that, that's quite difficult. So if you have a back-end system that has this information, do the hard work for people. Fill in the information you already have and don't expect people to remember numbers across multiple pages. It's definitely very difficult.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of these patterns that we're talking about, so things like the timer, and which are, I will say, I think, often set arbitrarily very low. So, you know, you mentioned 10 seconds there. I think that's not always uncommon. And then, you know, we've talked about things like the reference numbers and disabling paste on input fields and that kind of thing. And I think that a lot of these things, like, sometimes there will be a genuine need to do that. But a lot of the time, it feels like one of those things that has just become commonplace that actually we probably don't need to be doing. So I think it kind of hammers home for me why it's so important to be asking ourselves, kind of, why are we doing it this way? Why are we asking for this information? Why are we creating this interaction? Do we really need to be? And is there a more inclusive way of doing it?
Yeah, absolutely. Another piece of advice or a tip would be to let people make mistakes when they enter numbers. So if you can, from a validation point of view, if you can, you would use invalidate letter. So sometimes if I'm inputting a number, I'll put a letter in. So a really good example of this is the letter O and the number zero. They're quite close together on a keyboard and I'm forever getting them, different. And so I often put the wrong one in. Or, for example, sometimes I get the number 7 and L, the letter L.
Yeah.
Because to me, they look quite similar, the capital L. I know they're upside down, but in my brain, they look similar.
Yeah, like the shape.
Yeah, exactly. So if you have a number, a form entry field, and it's to do with numbers, you can extrapolate any letters from that. That's great. Because there's nothing more dehumanizing than seeing 4 or 5 error messages in a row. And on some services, you get like 3 attempts. And so I can pretty much guarantee that I'll never enter a form field correct first time. The only exception is if I have the opportunity to write it down on paper first. But if I'm using my phone, if I'm out and about, I can't do that. And so without having to really look at focusing on every single number, I'm guaranteed to get it wrong. So I know that I've already used up one of my lives, my attempt lives. So that means I've got 2 left. So that just makes me more anxious. And then sometimes I check like up to 10 times if I'm using a number that's on my phone and I have to put it on my laptop, I get into the spiral of just obsessive checking because I'm so worried about doing this wrong. And there's a great piece of advice that I was given, which was people tend to think that it's us that are wrong. So internally, they might think I'm doing it wrong, I'm getting it wrong. But it's actually the service that's getting it wrong, I think, in this place, because they haven't tested perhaps with the right people or thought about every kind of everyone's case. And so it's about relearning that sort of that trauma, because I remember at school being late to class and I was chastised by teachers. And then obviously I would get letters sent home and my parents wouldn't be happy with me either for being late. So I would be at the door for class like 20 minutes early. So I've wasted a lot of time being early to things. And I think that trauma never really goes away. And it kind of comes up when you're doing the most simplest thing, like logging onto PayPal or banking or whatever. But it comes up nonetheless. And I still feel that anxiety and shame and I'm doing it wrong. So it's just about reteaching that and making sure that services and people who design services can help me with that trauma, because I believe that they can.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's this is a real kind of theme, again, that we've sort of heard throughout the series here around how the role that design systems can play in kind of re-traumatizing people if we're not being mindful of kind of different circumstances, I suppose, and different experiences and different contexts that people have. And I certainly think in the kind of example of dyscalculia, what's sort of struck me about what you've said is really how many facets of life it affects, and actually really important things. So things like scheduling, security, we've talked about, finances, you know, data, and it's a bombardment of data that we have nowadays. Like you say, things like the pandemic and climate change have really brought that into stark focus, because we are constantly being shown stats. And I think even those of us who don't suffer with dyscalculia can sometimes become quite overwhelmed by those numbers. So would you say it's kind of like, is it about providing alternative formats a lot of the time for people to digest kind of numbers and information that's given in that way?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the things that I have planned to test this year is a toggle approach to content. And there's a really good example of this. And if you're a lot of content, specifically numbers, are presented in tables or graphs or charts. Now that information could be really important. It could be, you know, a medical thing that you're trying to, you know, decipher. It could be your utility bills usually come in a sort of a table format. So this is really bad for me for two reasons. The first is obviously I struggle to follow the linear line of a table. So if you imagine you're looking at a spreadsheet, imagine there's a plug in the middle of the page and then someone unplugs it. All the numbers come into the center. That's what it's like looking at a spreadsheet. It's almost like the numbers are distorted into the center. So it's really hard to pick out a number within a spreadsheet. And then you have the added stress of the lines and the grids.
Yeah.
So it's so exhausting looking at numbers on the table. And so a really great way to get around this. So I'm going to mention an organization called Plain Numbers, and they work with banks and utility providers, and they help them to simplify their kind of banking and utility content. And they come up with a phrase called a story format. So you're pulling out the information from the table and you're telling it as a story. So the example that they use on their report is of a utility bill in a table format. And it said something like, the gas, electricity, and then on the right-hand side, it had the number. But then they had this story format, which was, you know, between the months of January till May, you used 600 and something pounds in gas, and then X amount of pounds in electricity. And so we're going to bill you this amount. And it just basically put the story into it, put the data into a story format, which I found really, really pleasing.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking, what if you had a toggle so people who enjoy numbers and love stats and data could still use the service? Because what we don't want to do is diminish the experience for other people. So it's not like blanket remove all tables and data for good. But if we had a toggle where you could toggle between this sort of data heavy, dense spreadsheet or table, and then a written out story format of the information, that'd be quite cool, I thought, as a way of getting around that.
That's a really good idea. And actually, this is one that sort of I find kind of I can resonate with on a personal level, because actually this was it for me when you started talking about dyscalculia that made me think maybe I have that, because like you, I had difficulty telling the time till I was quite old. I remember having my mum sort of in a panic at one point buying me an early learning centre like time poster to have in my room to, you know, as a teenager at that point. And I had this headmistress who used to try and deal with this by stopping me in the corridor at random points and saying, what's the time? Like you, anytime anyone asks me the time now, I'm like, oh God, it's horrible. Big tangent was to kind of bring us back to the data visualization thing is also something that I really, really struggle with. So when I'm watching presentations, and I remember it too from the COVID pandemic and the COVID briefings that we had in the UK, whenever I look at a kind of graph or data that's displayed in any way other than that story format that you just mentioned, I just something about my brain just cannot pass it. And especially if I'm watching a kind of time limited thing, so if I have a bit of time with it myself, you know, I might be able to make sense of it. But when I'm watching a presentation, it's really challenging to digest that information. I often just can't. So if I'm, you know, if I'm at a conference or something and somebody's presenting lots of information in tables and graphs and stuff, I tend to just sort of shut my eyes and try to listen to the story that they're telling, rather than try and decipher the graph and what it's telling me. Something that I find helpful, which I think kind of maps to what you're saying, is when people supplement slides with a sentence or something as well that just kind of describes what the data is showing, because I do find it too difficult to digest. Sorry, I've taken us down my own personal rabbit hole there. But I guess like what I wanted to ask as well is, how does this for you, how does this kind of intersect with dyslexia? Because you also have dyslexia, don't you?
Yeah, I do, yes. So I have heard from a sort of specialist that dyslexia and dyscalculia often occur together. And along with things like dyspraxia as well. So I wasn't diagnosed until about a year ago, because obviously, as I mentioned, living with learning like early school leavers and not having support at school, it didn't really occur to me. I think I felt a lot of shame. I'm also a content designer, and I've worked in writing in some capacity for 10 years. So I kind of wanted to avoid numbers so much I went into writing, but then the dyslexia, it was really hard to write. So it was, I just felt like a fraud. I was like, oh my God, what are you doing here? Like, what are you doing? And maths really dictates your career opportunities in so many ways, even jobs that don't require any maths skill. Well, any maths at all require you to do a maths test of some kind as part of the interview process. I remember one interview, someone asked me, how many windows are there in London? As like a curveball strategic question.
Oh God.
And I just bombed. That was awful. I had no idea. I had no idea to where to start. I was flustered. I didn't get the job. It was a horrendous question. Please don't ask maths-based calculations.
No, that's horrible.
Yeah. Anyway, where was I?
You were talking about how sort of dyslexia, you're a content designer with dyslexia.
So I felt this level of fraud and shame for a long time, and struggling to see words, because sometimes they appear in the wrong order, sometimes they're distorted, as in they look fuzzy on screen, sometimes they're backwards. And so it was just mentally exhausting having to really focus in on the words and using like several different spell checker tools, asking people to review things for me. And I have a real bugbear about spelling errors. And I think sometimes we go all in on spelling errors. If we see one or a grammar or a spelling error, we just jump on it and go, oh, that's wrong. But we have to think about who's writing this stuff. And, you know, it could be someone who's really stressed. It could be someone who's just moved into the UK and their English isn't great just yet. And so this whole idea about shaming people around spelling and proper written English. And I actually decided to leave a master's degree a couple of years ago because they wanted me to write so academically and I really struggled.
Yeah.
I wanted to write in a simple way, mm-hmm. because that was helpful for me, but they wanted me to write in an academic way, and I really struggled and I had to leave. And I think education, it needs an education about how this academic style of writing probably doesn't suit the purpose of what they're trying to do, which is educate people, ironically. So dyslexia, dyspraxia and dyscalculia, I've heard are closely related and they often co-occur with people. But I think if you're going through a diagnosis, so I spoke to an expert in dyscalculia first and then was diagnosed with dyslexia as well. But I'm not quite sure if doctors, if GPs, if teachers are going to bring this up, you know, if you're a child or if you're an adult. Because the thing is, if it's not detected in childhood, you grow up with this feeling that you're wrong and everyone's better than you and you don't get the help you need. And then it gets harder because then you get stubborn. You know, you get used to how you're living. And so you won't get help. And then the NHS waiting lists are 3 or 4 years. And so then you're waiting more and people drop out of that and things like that. So. But I don't believe that you need to get a professional diagnosis. I think self-diagnosis is just as good if you recognise these things about yourself, or if anything I've discussed today resonates with you. You don't have to pay extortionate fees for private care or wait for 4 years. Unfortunately, that's the lay of the land. But there's loads of resources online and you know, please come speak to me directly if you need help or you want to talk to someone. I also just want to shout out to the Dyscalculia Network. They've been really great. They do support adults and young people with dyscalculia, and they're just all round good eggs. So if you're kind of listening and you're thinking, oh, this could be me, then please just give them a search and a follow on Twitter. I'm sure they'll love it.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. And I guess just to kind of tie this all together. So we've talked about the sort of what you were saying before about how you kind of internalize a lot of this and you tell yourself you're wrong and you're now having to try and unlearn that and untangle that for yourself. That reminded me a bit of the kind of social model of disability, where we talk about people being disabled people because it's not, you know, they're not people with disabilities. It's not them. It's the world around them that is disabling them. And I think, I guess where that kind of leads me is just in terms of design systems and those of us who are working in the space of kind of tech and UX and designing services and products and applications, it really does feel like there's opportunities for us to design our services in a way that are just more inclusive by default, and probably would be helpful for everybody.
I think so, yeah. I think... the biggest challenge you'll have is finding people to research with. So I advocate for researching with people who struggle with numbers. Just to give you some stats on this, about 1 in 20 people have dyscalculia in the UK.
Wow, so it's quite high.
Low numeracy affects half of working age adults And one in five people say they would avoid jobs that involve numbers. So we're talking about a lot of people here. And like I said, a lot of people may kind of internalize that they struggle with numbers, but haven't reached out yet, haven't quite acknowledged that they are struggling, want to hide it or mask it. So it's really important that we're doing research with people who struggle with numbers. If anyone needs help with that after this, please get in touch, because I could probably help you to find participants to speak to, me myself included. I've done lots of user research. I'd be a participant in user research for various sessions and services. And again, if you are open to being a research participant, please get in touch. I'm trying to build up a little network of people to research with, because it is a struggle to find people.
Yeah, that I think that's so important. And again, a kind of a real theme of this podcast has been speaking to people with lived experiences of whatever it is that we're talking about, because actually that's the best way for us to design services that are more inclusive, rather than just trying to guess at what we should do or shouldn't do. The final thing that I guess I wanted to talk about with you, Laura, was so you've been part of the Dyscalculia Network in government, in the UK government, mm-hmm. is that right?
Yeah,
and
it is.
You created these posters, which is for those who don't work in the UK government, we have these kind of accessibility posters, which are, they cover kind of a range of disabilities and learning differences and things. And they talk about sort of design do's and don'ts for people with particular types of disability. And I just wondered if you could share a couple of things from that poster and tell people where they can find it if they want to, for those of us who are working in this area and might want to just make a couple of improvements that might help people with dyscalculia.
Yeah, absolutely. So November last year, I worked with some incredible people. I'm going to name drop them because they're awesome. So Jay McFadden at DWP and Rachel Malik at HMRC, we're all content designers. So we created the accessibility poster called Designing for Dyscalculia and Low Numeracy, and they follow the Home Office do's and don'ts, as you've said. We had great help from Craig Abbott of the DWP Accessibility Manual. He was the head of accessibility at DWP, and the posters are hosted on the DWP Accessibility Manual, and that's what you can search for. And they're under the Tools tab. So if you go onto the Accessibility Manual, go to Tools and they're there. And we also had incredible help from Ollie Sweetman of the Civil Service Dyslexia and Dyspraxia Network, and he helped do the design. We're very grateful for that. So we promoted the poster on the Designing Gov blog, and it became the most viewed post of 2023, even though it was only published in November. So we were really happy about that. Since we launched the poster, it's appeared on podcasts, it's been shared worldwide, it's been translated into German as well by Martin Jordan. Thank you, Martin. And the Centre for Digital Public Services has used our guidance to train their digital teams. And we've had lots of great feedback and pictures of the poster on the wall and things like that. It's been awesome. Yeah, so it's hosted on the DWP Accessibility Manual.
Brilliant. We can pop a link in the show notes as well for it. And
thank you.
Could you just give us a couple of examples of what's covered in the poster? So like just a couple of do's and don'ts.
Yeah, of course. So obviously we could only fit so much content on here, and there was probably hundreds of things we could cover. So we have on our do round numbers to the nearest whole number, and that just helps to get rid of any unnecessary content on the page. We've got do leave space around numbers, as I've seen before. As I've said before, sometimes if it distorts and it's closed in and it's surrounded by other content, it's hard to see. Fill in the information you already have. Use sentences to add context about numbers. Do let people include spaces when entering numbers as well. This is a classic case of postcode. Sometimes on a form field, you're allowed to leave a space when you enter a postcode, and sometimes you're not, and there's an error, and that's really frustrating. There was some research came out about how people like to copy number inputs from, for example, a credit card. So they like to copy the number as it appears on their credit card or debit card. So if your service diverts from that, that's going to be a bit jarring for people. Okay, so on our do nots, we've got don't use decimals unless it's money. Again, I think I described how sometimes decimals can be just a bit confusing. And we have on here, don't overwhelm people too much with content. Don't use tables or grids without explaining what the numbers mean. And don't rush people to enter numbers accurately as well. So those are just a kind of handful of tips that hopefully you can pick up today and start changing your designs and making them more accessible.
Laura, thank you so much for coming on. This has been such an interesting conversation. And I really think that there's some nice actionable things there that people who are working in this space can take away and can do. As I said, I'll include a link to the poster in the show notes, as well as some other links and services that you've mentioned that can help people who think they might have this or people that just want to help. But yes, thank you so much for your time. It's been a delight to talk to you. And I will look forward to the response to this episode, which I'm sure will be epic.
Thank you, Amy. Thanks for having me on. And thanks for doing all you do for disabled folks and for accessibility.
Thanks, Laura. That was Laura Parker, content designer and inclusive language consultant, talking about design systems and dyscalculia. You can find all of the links mentioned in today's episode, including the dyscalculia poster that we discussed, and a link to Laura's Twitter profile and her website in the show notes. Thank you to Chris Iansen and James Bevan at 199 for production support, and to Ollie Strang for the episode artwork. We'll be back next week with a new episode. And until then, thank you for listening to Systems of Harm, a podcast by Frankly Design. If you like what you heard, please leave us a review on your favourite podcast platform, and don't forget to subscribe to stay up to date with all of our latest episodes. If you've got any feedback or suggestions for future episodes, I'd love to hear from you. You can reach me on Twitter at Amy_Hupe, or you can email me at hello@wearefrankly.co. Thank you again for listening, and we'll see you next time.